At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
$135 for a U.S. passport, everybody, and that's on the up and up. Black market? I don't know. Priceless, maybe? The illegal passport business coming up today. We'll have that, the birth of the web, and tin, atomic number 50, as well, from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Great to have you here on this Tuesday, everybody. It's the 11th of March, and the fact of the matter is that we're not that much closer to knowing what happened to Malaysia Airlines Flight 370 today than we were when it went missing 4 days ago. There are suggestions today the plane turned to the west at some point, further complicating the search, and Malaysian officials have now said that the two passengers traveling on stolen passports were not likely to have been related to terrorist groups. But the incident has exposed what Interpol calls a massive problem of fake passports, as Marketplace's Bree Benishore reports.
We did not have to go far to find someone whose passport had been stolen.
Margarita Noriega, digital editor at Marketplace.
A week ago, she was dancing at a club in Miami for her birthday, and
my passport was stolen, my iPhone was stolen from my purse, which was on my body.
Noriega is one of at least 3.2 million U.S. citizens whose passports have either been lost or stolen since 2004. Shahida Tulaganova knows what happens next. She's bought dozens of stolen passports.
Greek, Irish, Polish.
And she's used them to open bank accounts and cross borders. Tulaganova is an investigative journalist who went undercover for a documentary on passport theft.
What will happen, the passport is stolen by a petty criminal who is working in a chain of 10 people.
Tulaganova says Noriega's passport has probably been fed into one of many international criminal gangs. The passports will end up sitting in a warehouse, and when an order is placed, the warehouse gets a call. Got any U.S. passports? How about an Irish passport? It's doctored and sent out to
Anywhere. That's why it's so difficult to trace.
As the Malaysian Air incident has revealed, many countries don't even compare passports against available lists of stolen documents. The passports can be used years after being stolen or just a few weeks later.
The reason these people are so fast, because they're making money.
A top-quality forgery can go for $7,000 or more, and even a bad fake can have the information taken from it to apply for a real passport under a new name.
That is becoming even a bigger problem than the stolen passports.
Michael Greenberger directs the University of Maryland's Center for Health and Homeland Security. He says many people use stolen passports to seek asylum or just get a job. But
the overwhelming use of illegal passports is to cause human misery.
Everything from laundering money to smuggling slaves and worse. I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
There is news of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac today. The GSEs, that stands for government-sponsored entities, by the way. The GSEs that back most 30-year fixed mortgages in this country. The two leaders of the Senate Banking Committee, one a Democrat, the other a Republican, have moved forward in that rarest of things in Congress of late, a bipartisan plan that would wind the mortgage financiers down. To review, Fannie and Freddie are pretty much owned by you and me. They needed and got a $187 billion bailout just as the financial crisis was getting going 5 years ago. And ever since, there has been much talk, but little agreement of how to shut them down and make sure that never has to happen again. There are, of course, hurdles to any potential agreement, including the inconvenient fact that at the moment, Fannie and Freddie are making bazoodles of money for the U.S. Treasury. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman explains.
The plan from the Senate Banking Committee would shut down Fannie and Freddie and create a new government entity just to guarantee mortgages. Private sector firms would then bundle those mortgages into securities and sell them to investors. Guy Sakala at Inside Mortgage Finance says this new system would generate business and profits for Wall Street.
There's no question it would be a boom for large financial institutions, mostly banks, who would take over that activity and, to some extent, that risk.
In the new system, the first 10% of losses, if mortgages went bad, would be absorbed by private investors, not the government. That's to protect taxpayers from another bailout. But would it?
Just like we couldn't afford to let Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac fail, the question is, would we be able to allow large banks to fail if they were propping up the mortgage market by issuing government-guaranteed mortgage securities?
Conservatives want to get government out of this business altogether. Alex Pollack at the American Enterprise Institute says any replacement of Fannie and Freddie that guarantees mortgages could distort the market, and that could lead to another housing crisis. But Pollack admits there are a lot of vested interests who want some government backstop to remain.
Anybody who makes money off having that government guarantee to sell houses, if you're a home builder or a mortgage broker, to trade securities, if you're a Wall Street firm.
And Congress may hesitate to do anything right now. After all, Fannie and Freddie are highly profitable, delivering billions to the U.S. Treasury every month. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
The February numbers on Obamacare came out today. The White House says since October the 1st, about 4.2 million people have signed up, the same percentage of young and presumably healthy 18 to 34-year-olds as last month, about a quarter of the total. There are 3 weeks left, by the way, until the March 31st deadline to avoid penalties for not signing up. On Wall Street today, woulda, coulda, shoulda, man, story of my life. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Tomorrow's the 25th anniversary of the World Wide Web. But if you tell people the web's only been around for a quarter century, they'll say, no, man, the Internet's been around a lot longer than that. It's been around since, like, the 70s or something. Well, therein, ladies and gentlemen, lies the rub, because the web and the Internet are not, I repeat, not the same thing. Marketplace's Queenie Kim explains.
This week, I met one of the inventors of the Internet.
Hi, my name is Don Nielsen. I'm a leftover from the early days of the Internet.
And I understand that you were one of the guys who helped create the web.
Absolutely not. Had nothing to do with the web.
Nielsen doesn't have a problem with the word web. He's got a problem that I don't know the difference between that and the Internet. In the 70s, Nielsen was a computer scientist at SRI, a tech research company. He says back then, the U.S. military wanted to find a way to communicate using computers. And Nielsen's team basically helped establish the protocols or rules that got computer networks around the world to talk to each other. Really simply put, that's what the Internet still is today. A global connection of computer networks.
In the late 80s, the Internet was growing really fast. It had gone from 200 computers or so back at the beginning of the decade to over 500,000.
Mark Weber is a curator at the Computer History Museum in Silicon Valley. He says back then, computers were mostly owned by universities, governments, and large computing companies like IBM. They saw the value of the Internet as a fast way to communicate and to gather and transfer large amounts of information. The problem was how to access that information easily, which is where the corporations came in.
The easy-to-use interfaces were in the commercial systems. So like CompuServe, which had its own network, was easy for anybody to use. Minitel in France, which had, by that time, well over 10 million users, was also easy to use, but that was owned by France Telecom.
The Internet was becoming a patchwork of information superhighways owned by companies. And it could have developed that way were it not for a man named Sir Tim Berners-Lee. Brad Templeton is a professor at Singularity University. He says Berners-Lee wrote a paper published 25 years ago tomorrow that suggested managing all the information on the Internet in a different way.
One of the great realizations is that you think you want to do it structured. You think you have a vision of the order of how it should all work and be laid out.
Berners-Lee argued that information on the Internet shouldn't be confined to a structure.
The idea is that you don't have an official hierarchy. Remember the Dewey Decimal System? You'd go in and you'd say, okay, let's look up information on science. And then in science, there'll be anthropology and so on. You'll go down and find things. Instead, it's just a big sea of documents.
Documents or web pages that could be found quickly by punching in an address and where information would be linked to other pages, thereby creating a web of information. It took Berners-Lee a couple of years to actually create the first website, and when he did, he made the technology free for anybody to use. Templeton says it wasn't until 1994, when the web browser Netscape was introduced, that the web became known to the general public. But he says Berners-Lee's proposal came to define the ethos of the web.
Look at Google and Facebook and all these other companies that didn't have any idea how they were going to make money when they began. And they were able to become some of the world's biggest companies because they got that zone in which they could just go out and do it and didn't need to ask anyone's permission. That's what gave us all this innovation.
And Templeton says that it's that idea, a way to access all the information on the internet through the World Wide Web, that we're celebrating. In San Francisco, I'm Queenie Kim for Marketplace.
The price of copper took a digger today, down almost 3% on the New York Mercantile Exchange, due, as happens sometimes in capitalism, to some convoluted trades and financing deals over in China. It's not copper, specifically, that we're interested in today, but another related non-ferrous metal that is oh so important to the way things work. Our every now and then contributor Justin Rowlett from the BBC business program Business Daily has been working on a series about individual chemical elements and how they affect the global economy. It's called Elementary Business, and today it's tin, symbol SN on the periodic table, atomic number 50, as I said earlier. Justin, how are you?
I'm very well indeed, Kai. How are you today?
I'm well. Tin is the topic at hand.
I know. It doesn't sound very interesting,
no.
Does it?
So what?
But it is.
All right, go.
Well, it is quite interesting. You know, I mean, what I hadn't really understood about tin was that it was key to, if you like, the first technological revolution man ever undertook. And that was the development of bronze, hence the Bronze Age, when we mixed tin with copper, two quite soft metals, to create a much harder alloy. And mankind found this crucially kept a sharp edge. So they started making tools and particularly weapons out of it. And, you know, we moved away. This is how we moved away from the Stone Age, thanks to tin. So tin's right there at the very kind of dawn of civilization.
Talk to me about today then. I mean, let's fast forward, you know, 40,000 years.
5,000.
All right, 5,000.
But no, it's not that long ago that we, you know, these developments were made. It gives you a sense of man's progress, I suppose. So what is tin used for? Well, amazingly, tin is actually the glue that holds the modern world together, in the sense that tin is the basis of solder, which is used in all electronics.
Oh, soldering,
so tin
yeah.
still has an absolutely crucial role in the world. And the other extraordinary thing that I discovered about tin is its role in glass manufacture, which
really?
I had no idea about.
All right, well, now you have to tell me about that.
Sheet glass is now made using the float glass process, Kai, which is when you float molten glass on a bath of molten tin, which
really?
Obviously allows it to become completely flat. Yes. And it's actually very recent that that development took place. Before that, glass was incredibly labor-intensive, hot, dirty, dangerous process. You know, now it's a much cleaner, much less labor-intensive process, much safer process. And one of the reasons why glass is so cheap now, and also why you can make glass in such huge sizes, which allow the kind of, you know, beautiful you know, gossamer thin, you know, tower blocks that we see now.
I wonder who thought of that. You know, let's melt some tin, let's melt some glass-making stuff and see what happens.
Well, do you know what, Kai? It was an English bloke.
Yeah, sure.
No, it was. A guy called Alistair Pilkington. He came up with it in 1953, I think.
Do we have a lot of tin? I mean, you know, it seems fairly useful.
It is quite useful, and there is quite a lot of it around. It's not that rare, which is one of the reasons you could have this float glass method could use lead, but it's a bit poisonous. It could use silver. It could use gold. Those metals are a bit expensive. So one of the reasons why tin is used is because it's relatively abundant and relatively cheap.
All right. Be good. Justin Rowlett from the BBC. Thank you, sir.
Cheers, Kai.
Coming Coming up, you want to understand Pakistan? Try Garth Brooks.
Out of the corner of my ear, I hear this Garth Brooks song, you know, and I just think to myself, the dance? Is that the dance?
I don't know. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is off 0.4% today, 67 points, closed at 16,351, did the blue chips. The NASDAQ took off 0.6%, 27 points, finished at 4307. The S&P 500 down 0.5%, 9 points, 1867 there. Financial firms felt some pain. Citigroup erased 2.3%. Goldman Sachs traded down 2%. Today, we told you earlier about Fannie Mae. Shares got clobbered, down 30.30%. There is teen trouble with a capital T in retail. American Eagle reversed nearly 8% today after lowering earnings expectations. Urban Outfitters threw off more than 4% after its earnings disappointed Wall Street. If you're looking to buy a Tesla in New Jersey, forget about it. The state has banned direct sales of the cars. Tesla will close two showrooms as a result. Shares in the electric car maker fell 4.5%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the House Small Business Committee holds a hearing on how 3D printing can create opportunities for entrepreneurs. President Franklin D. Roosevelt began a series of radio broadcasts during the Great Depression. The first fireside chat, delivered on March 12, 1933, dealt with banking. And time to put your green thumb to practice. It's Plant a Flower Day. Digging in the dirt is cathartic. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. We've all seen glitzy fashion ads, right? Billboards, of course, glossy magazine spreads to maybe television sometimes. You know the drill, right? A growing number of fashion companies, though, are branching out. They're using short films to promote their brands, as Audrey Quinn reports.
Lauren Wolkstein has her eyes glued to YouTube. She's watching the latest Wes Anderson movie.
No! Oh, that was Jason Schwartzman in a car and he just crashed.
The film's not for theaters. It's for Prada, the fashion label. It's just about 7 minutes long.
Water! This is actually very entertaining.
Just about every major fashion house now has a short indie film online. Prada commissioned Wes Anderson. Yves Saint Laurent used Darren Aronofsky. Dior got Sofia Coppola to make its movie. Lauren Wolkstein, the woman watching the movie, is an indie director herself. She's had 3 films at Sundance, and she's made a fashion film for Gucci.
To me, it was like, oh, I don't have to worry about dressing the actors. I don't have to worry about the location. They gave me everything to play with, and I was able to tell a story with these amazing clothes.
Wolkstein says it can take years to raise enough money to finance a film, even for established indie directors. Commissions from big brands take that problem away.
They're saying, I love your work. Here's some money. Pretty much take this money and run with it and tell your stories. And the only requirements, if any, is to put the name and the brand on the film.
She says having a fashion brand as your patron, giving you free rein, it actually raises a filmmaker's street cred. But what's in it for the brand?
I think fashion brands struggled for a long time to go online.
That's Quinn Mai. She's founder of the agency Moving Image and Content. She helps fashion companies with digital marketing.
They sell exclusivity, aspiration. And for a long time, the online space was the antithesis of that.
But having a web film with a fancy director, that gives fashion houses the exclusivity they're aiming for.
When brands like Prada spend exorbitant amount of monies on their films online, they're trying to create a halo effect for their brand that crosses not only their target consumer, but maybe the consumer who buys their sunglasses or buys their nail polish.
But, Mai says, when brands hire big-name directors to make their films, it can take away attention from the brand.
Because all people say is, have you seen that Wes Anderson short? I'm not sure that that was a Prada piece.
So far, the Wes Anderson film for Prada only has about 400,000 views on YouTube, which makes it about 30 times less popular than a home video of a baby shooting a basketball. In New York, I'm Audrey Quinn for Marketplace.
When we hear about Pakistan, it's usually about what the government there did or didn't do. It's about the war on terror or the Taliban or what's going on next door in Afghanistan. It's not often that we hear about the Pakistani people and what their lives are like. Those people, one particular family, in fact, is the subject of a new book. It's by Haroon Ullah, who's got a day job on the policy planning staff at the State Department. The book is called The Bargain from the Bazaar, A Family's Day of Reckoning in Lahore. Haroon, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
This is a work of nonfiction. It is true, but it reads like a novel, and it reads like a novel in which the sense of place is so, so paramount. So do me a favor and get us going by telling me about this bazaar, the Anarkali Bazaar in Lahore, Pakistan.
Absolutely. It's one of the most fascinating places I've ever been to. You know, it's this one of the oldest surviving marketplaces in South Asia, over 300 years old. And for me, it was just, you know, it was remarkable because you realize how small the world is. I remember I was in this bazaar in Anarkali when out of the corner of my ear, I hear this Garth Brooks song, you know, and I just think to myself, the dance? Is that the dance?
Wow.
And I go over to a stall and this guy is playing Garth Brooks is the dance on a battery operated player. And I just thought, my gosh, this world is much smaller than I'd ever think.
How did you find this family, the protagonist family, the Reza family, about whom you write?
I met them in 2004, and I actually went to Pakistan to do research on the military and met them at a dinner party. And Awais was talking about his POW story.
He's the patriarch, right?
Yeah, the patriarch. Met him, met Shez, his wife, who's this amazing, strong woman who is, you know, really sort of the glue of the family, and then their kids.
He had inherited the shop that he runs in the bazaar from his dad, always had, they were not prosperous, but they were, you know, sort of middle class, hanging on. And then the story of their descent out of the middle class in this book is kind of amazing.
Absolutely. And that's, you know, the thing about the Reza family that, you know, they taught me about triumph and resilience and how do you sort of make sense of the world around you? How do you cope with that stress? And, you know, they are very blue collar, and yet they're able to, as a family, find a way to move on amidst the sort of tragedy that they oftentimes experience, the violence. Everybody's affected by that. And so my goal was to sort of, how do you unpack this, make it accessible, humanize it, allow people to peek into these sort of dinner table conversations and get a sense for, you know, how people may not be all that different than folks back here.
There is, it has to be said, opportunity. I mean, one of the sons of this family has a university scholarship.
That's right. That's right. And it's, you know, that's what was so remarkable about the story is that within one family, and I met many families like this, you have the same set of parents, you know, and you have kids that have gone off in divergent paths. And it's a struggle of parents. Oftentimes late at night, you know, we would sit over a series of mangoes. I always joke, you know, with all due respect to Greg Mortensen and three cups
three
of tea,
yeah.
It's really three mangoes. You want to get to know somebody, the best icebreaker in the world is eating a mango. So Kai, I don't know if you've eaten a, you know, mango with your bare hands, but you rip it apart.
Not in a bazaar in Pakistan, yeah.
Oh my gosh. And it's drooling and it's dripping. And I guarantee you, you eat three mangoes with someone, you're best friends because all your guard is down and you get to know someone in a hurry. And so oftentimes over mangoes, sitting with this family, talking late at night, I mean, the parents would tell me, you know, did we do something wrong? Did we fail as parents? What could we have done differently in terms of raising our kids? Because they want better for their kids than they had for themselves. They're willing to sacrifice everything.
The book is called The Bargain from the Bazaar. It's by Haroon Ullah. Haroon, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks so much, Kai. Quite an honor.
This is the season of the television pilots. Networks are shelling out boatloads of cash to produce what they hope will be mega hits. Of course, most of the pilots produced each season are not mega hits, not even micro hits. The vast majority of them don't even make it to air. But there is a way to tell which ones the studios might be banking on. It's sort of like a pilot prenuptial agreement. It's probably called a put-pilot commitment, as Marketplace's David Weinberg explains.
Let's say you're a bright-eyed young TV writer. You've just pitched your first pilot to the networks, and they love it. Actors are hired, sets built, the pilot is shot, and it's terrible. The studio kills the project and tells you to get lost. Welcome to Hollywood. Now, if your pilot had what's called a put-pilot commitment, things would have gone much differently.
Put-pilot means that the network or the studio behind the pilot has ordered it and committed to putting it on the air.
Ben Travers is TV editor for IndieWire. The put gets added because it means the show will be put into production. Here's the explicit commitment that's made. If the network doesn't air the show, it pays you a hefty penalty. That happened last year with Eddie Murphy's Beverly Hills Cop TV series. So how does a pilot get put?
Well, if it's a sexy, hot script by a very hot writer, then you're going to have competition all over town.
Jay Gendron is a former executive with Warner Brothers. He says studios can gain an edge over other networks by offering put pilot commitments for a show. But that usually happens only with big stars or with writers who've proven themselves with past hits, or if there is a buzz, like there was in 2000 with a show called The Fugitive.
And that was supposed to be the highly touted pilot of the year. We spent gobs of money on the pilot. There was another little show that aired at the same time. And what happened?
What happened was The Fugitive was canceled after one season, and that other little show became the number one show on television, CSI, proving that throwing money at a pilot can secure a hot series, but that doesn't guarantee it will be a hit. I'm David Weinberg from Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out today, I'm relieved to be able to tell you that our long national menswear nightmare is over with. The back and forth between Men's Warehouse and Joseph A. Bank has finally come to a close. After months of we're going to buy you, no, we're going to buy you, the thing ends like this. Men's Warehouse is going to pay $1.8 billion for its smaller, but if I may say so, classier competitor. Now, why they couldn't have figured this out months ago is completely beyond me. Also, just one more time, I am not Audie Cornish. All right, we're done. We got to go. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow shed 0.4%, 67 points. The NASDAQ took off 0.6%, 27 points. The S&P 500 slid 0.5%, 9 points. Nancy Fargali is the special projects producer. John Ketsum is the producer on the Wealth and Poverty Desk. Our digital producers are Ariana Tobin and Raghu Madhavan. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will meet you back here tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.